Before I ask any questions about your sort of background in NPR, I will touch upon the LinkedIn again. It says on a boat, no, we don't want to sponsor your podcast. Sorry. Is that because you knew you were coming on tonight, or was that a longstanding a bio?
It's because Adam just won't leave me alone with requests for mine.
Hello and welcome to the PR Hub podcast. My name is Adam Tuckwell.
And I'm John Wilcox. Hey again, folks. We're recording this on the day after the US election, and it is so close. So we went and distracted ourselves and interviewed Lee Price, who is the head of PR and mischief at gambling giant Paddy Power. Brilliant and honest and open and never mind sometimes sweary, very sweary interview with Lee. Truly fascinating brand power of Paddy Power is incredibly strong. Fantastic campaigns they've run over the last sort of few years. And Lee was a great guest, Ads. I think
great insight from Lee talking about his journey working from The Sun. Spent 5 years working for The Sun before moving to PR, and a very honest interpretation of what it's like to be moving on that transition from being a journalist to being a PR, and lots of opportunities for advice on what makes a good story, what makes good insight, what works for Paddy Power, but what also works for you. So heaps of advice and interest and little stories in here. So we hope you very much enjoy the interview. Lee, welcome to the PR Hub podcast. In a world full of exceptionally boring LinkedIn profile, yours is an absolute delight. Tell me what prompted you to write your LinkedIn profile in such an honest and upfront tone.
Most likely procrastination. I probably had loads of expenses to file or something quite important that I just couldn't be asked to do. I don't know is the honest answer. I feel like it just reflects me better. And LinkedIn's a funny old place, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I kind of like subverting the genre, which is a terribly LinkedIn thing to say about someone who hates LinkedIn. But there you go. Said it.
You are clearly professional in what you do. And yet you do have this playful profile on LinkedIn, which does go against the typical LinkedIn. Because you've said you're head of PR and mischief. And Paddy Power. So I've never met too many heads of mischief. So what's that entail?
It's a good question. Mischief at Paddy Power is probably a Paddy Power phrase for activations or stunts or campaigns. But mischief is a phrase that's run throughout the business of Paddy Power and where it comes from. Just briefly, when they were formed to see off an English invasion of bookies coming over to Ireland to exploit a tax loophole, and they decided that the way to fend off the big boys was to create a quintessentially Irish brand, hence the name Paddy Power, hence the really green logo. I mean, no shit, I guess, now you think of it. And also hence this sort of personality that is imbued throughout the brand. And mischief is just the tongue-in-cheek naughtiness, the things Paddy Power is famous for. So being head of mischief means that I guess I'm responsible for carrying that stuff on.
That's great.
It's a great idea, at least.
It is. For those of you who are unfamiliar with your rise to PR glamour from those dark worlds of journalism, do you want to talk us through how you got into PR and what you were up to before? Because I saw Shoot magazine and got very excited. And then sometime The Sun. Tell us all about your career and your background.
Yeah, I studied sport journalism at uni, and I hated going to lectures, so instead sought to go out on work experience as much as I could, and the one that allowed me to be the least professional but also do the best stuff was Shoot magazine. So I started doing stuff for them really regularly, and as soon as I graduated, I got a job at Shoot magazine, which was incredible because one of our lecturers would tell us every single week, there's no jobs in journalism, you're wasting your time here, which was really, you know, motivational. So went to work for Shoot magazine. The thing with that job was that, as well as, you know, being one of the first British journalists to interview Yaya Toure after he joined Man City or lots of glamorous sounding football things, I also had to be like Cindy on Facebook, or I had to write the Pokemon annual or the 24 annual or the Go-Go's annual. which is fine, but wasn't the ultimate dream. Well, I mean, there probably was a dream about Cindy, but we won't go into that too much. So Shoot Magazine was my first job and I loved it. But then like 2 or 3 months into doing that full time, my mum sent me a clipping from the Sun newspaper, which was a competition called Column Idol, I kid you not, and just basically said, if you like writing, you're under the age of, must be under the age of 25, I guess, send in a column, and I did. And long story short, I got into the final six, and I turned up at the finalist day, and I realised it was me, someone who'd written something funny about being addicted to Facebook, and 5 sob stories, basically, people who had really interesting real-life stories, but were picked for their story about them rather than their necessarily their writing ability. So I realized I had a good shot of winning this thing, and I did. And that led to a job at the Sun. But I must say that it's probably important to clarify, I probably didn't do journalism at the Sun in the classic definition. I was a feature writer. And my role there was not dissimilar to what I do at Paddy Power, basically create self-indulgent ideas that get me doing fun stuff I can tell my mates about, and that was kind of my existence at the Sun. So I hosted a birthday party in my flat with celebrity guests, who were all like Z-listers. So basically, who can you get on a budget for your birthday party? And that was work. So I wasn't doing door knocks. I wasn't doing, you know, political investigations. I wasn't doing any of the murky stuff. I was basically writing entertainment stuff, which after a while weirdly sort of ran out of space in the Sun. Who knew? At which point I moved on.
Good work. Well,
so you were there for 5 years.
Yes. And I loved every second of it. But when it became apparent that if I was to stay another 5 years, I would have to change something quite different, I decided to leave and hand them a notice in.
That's fair. Do you remember who you got, Z-listers?
Of course I do. It was one of the best parties of my life. Well, I mean, yes. Wasn't even my actual birthday, which is, you know, the biggest sham of it all. But we got Stavros Flatley performing live in the living room. Michael Fish came and he helpfully sent some weather advice in advance, which was handy. We had Richard Blackwood, who was very, very uncomfortable being there. And when I remarked that he used to be a really big star, he took that really personally because obviously he felt like he was still doing
still
all right.
There.
He was still doing okay, yeah. Craig Phillips, the first winner of Big Brother. Oh, and Wagner from X Factor, who performed that famous Italian opera song, which I can't pronounce. And it started off probably quite beautiful, but got really, really, really high pitched and loud. And the neighbours started banging on the walls. So that was also good.
Wow.
That sounds like, it sounds like a party to remember.
The snacks were outrageous. So, yeah, it was.
Fantastic. So you spent 5 years for the Sun doing these exciting and wacky things, and that obviously gave you a taste for doing these exciting, outrageous, and certainly introduced you to the world of stunts or news hooks and things. Did you have much dealings with PRs when you were doing that, or was it mostly self-created content or working within the team?
No, there was a lot of dealings with PRs, and I think after a while I probably became a go-to person for a certain portion of PRs who thought, we need to do something ridiculous with this weird new thing we've got. Let's ask that loser from the Sun. And more often than not, I would say yes, because I love the sight of my own face in the paper and I've got no shame. So I did work a lot of PRs. Things like when the London Aquarium introduced a new shark diving tank randomly, who was the first to go and dive the sharks? Obviously it was me in a pair of Speedos, because apparently that was essential.
Why not?
Well, I mean, it wasn't my choice, but that was what I was told I had to wear. So, yeah, I mean, I got an insight into PR. I also got an insight into how journalists treat PR or perceive PRs. And obviously my subsequent journey has been quite interesting in balancing that bit out as well.
For those that haven't had experience of working in a busy newsroom, we get a taste as PRs as to what journalists think of PRs. Go into that in a little bit more detail. What do they think when their inbox gets full or their phone doesn't stop ringing?
PRs can be the bane of a journalist's life. It depends who the journalist is, but they're seen as a meal ticket by some, or they were anyway, certainly when I was a journalist 5 or so years ago. They're seen as an irritant, and like when the phone would ring, you have to answer because you work for a newspaper. But 5 times out of 6, it's a PR pitching you a story about, I don't know, pet insurance. And you feel bad for the person on the other side of the phone, but you think, fuck me, why have you called me? you could have called anyone else in this office, but you called me. So I would say the general culture at that time wasn't particularly warm towards PRs, but in the line of work I was specialising in, not much competition, I did recognise that PRs were my friend and they could have ideas for me, which makes my life easier, and they could facilitate stuff too. But there's definitely, like, you know, if we decided to do a Christmas taste test of Christmas puddings, for instance, the assumption would be you ring the Waitrose PR and they immediately courier you a Christmas pudding. Like, there was no nuance or black and white. It was just, you know, ring PR, they'll sort it out for you. they're your bitch, basically, I guess. And actually, sadly, it was true. That did work on quite a lot of occasions.
So we go from PRs being your bitch to I really want to be a PR person. How did that work? How did that transition there?
I was too soft to make any PRs my bitch, and I generally try to avoid free meals because I just hated the shit chat. I hated, you know, the dancing monkey bit of, right, I pay for your steak now, let's talk business. I didn't like that. When I decided to leave the Sun, my partner was pregnant, and it was quite a rash decision, but it felt right. I had things in journalism I could stay and do, but like Paddy Power wanted to talk to me and they explained the role. And it didn't sound like a PR role, I guess, because I think at that time I would have been a bit like, oh, PR, I'm not sure about that. But the Paddy Power PR gig wasn't and isn't a standard PR gig. I don't think, I'm sure everyone says this, but I think there's a lot of parallels between my existing role and the position at Paddy Power. I guess I saw some sort of comfort in that, or I didn't think I'd have to blag it entirely to make it work.
That concept of blagging is really interesting. So it sounds like your time at the Sun required you to wear many different hats, to be lots of different people, to come up with ideas and perform and showcase. So I can see how that would naturally align itself to a role at Paddy Power, where it's doing something different. Were you concerned when you moved to that role about your lack of experience in terms of PR? So we see it, and sometimes when highbrow experienced journalists like yourself jump into these high level comms roles, and you kind of worried whether they're gonna sink or swim. What was the transition like for you? Were there concerns, or was it essentially Paddy Power saw something in you, which was the ability to make mischief?
Yeah, I think they saw something I maybe didn't, or I hadn't quite realised. I was still quite young at the time. I was 25. And working for the Sun was all I'd really known as an adult, or, you know, approaching an adult. So, yeah, I was definitely very self-aware that I was going into this job at a great brand. I thought, you know, that lots of real PRs could do this better than me. So I felt like I had to really give it some to get up to speed. So I just worked my nuts off, really, and just learned as much as I could. And I think the benefit I had was I didn't want to be the sort of PR that I was terrified of, or not terrified of, but made me cringe. So I guess I wasn't that type of PR. I was more standoffish. I was less pushy. I was more just, you know, we're both here to have a drink, let's have a drink. Or we're both here to watch the football, let's watch football. You're my meal ticket. You know, it's not just one way, it's a two-way thing, right? I realised for the first time that PRs can go on jollies too. Hope my boss isn't listening. But, you know, I learned to do it my way, I think. And I think that's always important, isn't it? That you can try and copycat someone, but then you're only a diluted version of them. Whereas if you can try and make it work based on what you've learned from the last job, the very few things I had picked up, and it seemed to go okay, yeah.
So there won't be any listeners that haven't heard of Paddy Power and probably can't close their eyes and not see one of the stunts that you've probably been part of over your time there. And we've probably all got our favourites. You've done a huge variety of different things. I love the creativity that Paddy Power deliver, that your default isn't to float something down the Thames. It's to be much more creative, but also really responsive to the news agenda. So to play that reactive card. What does Paddy Power look like? What does PR at Paddy Power look like? So what's the team? What's the setup? How do you work with marketing and other stakeholders? And how much freedom do you have to just go and do things that you think will really resonate with your audience?
So PR, I report to the brand marketing director, or the marketing director. So I sit alongside marketing, alongside advertising, alongside CRM and all the grown-up stuff. So it's a core marketing function or channel. I think the PR team or department at Paddy Power isn't really judged on day-to-day press releases and, you know, oh, we've got our odds in the Daily Star, like, so what? It's more about creating and elevating creative work. So it's either coming up with a stunt or a campaign and delivering it, or it's working with our social team to elevate their latest amazing bit of content or whatever. So I've actually just reviewed our PR approach, and I've banned my team from sending out day-to-day press releases because, you know, when Man United sack Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, 10 bookmakers immediately email every sports journalist in the country saying, Pochettino is the odds-on favourite to replace him. And so it's a rat race. And if you win the rat race, your reward is a number and a little mention in very small print in an article in the newspaper online, the value of which is hard to define because our awareness is pretty high anyway, as you've mentioned. Yeah. And is that going to drive consideration or whatever? No. So we've now shifted more towards a brand PR focus, i.e. if you're going to put a press release out, it's because it's a totally off-the-wall story that only Paddy Power would be adding comment to or bringing to you, or it's our latest stunt, piece of content, etc.
I'm really interested in finding out, you've explained where you sit in the broader marketing function. How much does social media and social media engagement define the success of one of your PR campaigns? Because traditionally it would be, I'm going to say the now thankfully banned measurement of AVE. Of AVE, and thank God we have moved dramatically on from there. Engagement on social media is a key measurement these days. Is that more important for you, is to sort of see that sort of virality in social media for your stunts, or is it still seeing a picture or of the stunt in a tabloid or something like that? How do you measure success?
I'm greedy, so the answer is both, but it's a really fair point. I think I go to the marketing director and say, right, we've got this thing we want to do. This is how much it costs. This is why we're doing it. And then you say, and this is what the results should be. So I think we've moved, because when I first joined, you know, we were just saying, oh, we've got 100 hits this week. And they're like, oh, brilliant, 100 hits, that's great. And me being completely wet behind the ears, I was like, sorry, why is 100 hits great? What does that mean? So I created like an Olympic rating scale for quality of coverage, which my colleagues really fucking hated. Don't blame them. But we started measuring like quality of print or online coverage to go beyond just saying a random number and saying we've got 100 hits, including this amazing bit in the print in the Times and this amazing headline piece on Daily Star Online or whatever it might be. And now the media landscape's difficult. I think people are sick of bookmakers. People are sick of Paddy Power and our bullshit. I think there are lots of sponsorship deals that are under the hood that means certain places can't cover certain brands. So I think media coverage is difficult. That's not a cop-out. We still get it. But it does mean you can't rely solely on it. I think certain things we do, we try and be topical. We try and be reactive. We try and be finger on the pulse in terms of the tone and whatnot. So naturally, those three things all align themselves really well to social. So a lot of our stuff will be social first in terms of results. But for me, I still get a kick out of seeing something in print. And that's probably from my background, I guess, as a journalism student and having worked for a print title, but the best case scenario for me is everything. You know, we did a campaign last year, which I couldn't fucking avoid. Like, it was on TV, it was on radio, it was on, people on the train were talking about it. And that was the best thing I've ever done. That's the ultimate, where it's everywhere.
Which campaign was that?
It was Save Our Shirt with the Huddersfield Town.
Yes. Yeah. With the big, yeah. I remember it. I'm not even a football fan. And I definitely saw it. So and I'm more than familiar with it. So yeah, that's brilliant. That's absolutely fantastic.
My mum actually said to me when that was live, "Have you seen this thing that your company's done?" I was like, "Yeah."
Great, well done, mum.
My thing, mum.
Yeah, I can I just say I don't know your mum, but I love the fact that she did that after you did a sports journalism degree and you were a journalist for Shoot, or you were working for Shoot magazine and the respective publisher, and then she said about almost a proper job at the Sun when you enter a competition, because you're not already almost inferring like you're not actually a proper journalist at that point. So I really love you, mum. She sounds amazing.
A lot of my friends have said similar, particularly when we were at school. So yeah, bad memories.
Brilliant.
When you talk about stunts and people's views of Paddy Power and this brand piece, how does Paddy Power want to be seen? What is the goal for people to for the business, and how does it want to be seen? And do you find that there are a lot of ideas that get cast aside because they don't meet the brand idea of what you want to look at? Or is there this treadmill, we've got to have a better idea than the last one? What does it look like from a brand perspective?
A bit of all of that. I guess the brand, from people who don't engage with it regularly, is perhaps perceived, not wrongly, but in a way we might have been 5 years ago. So if you were to go back five or so years ago, the brand was quite laddy, in my opinion, was quite in your face and a bit abrupt, and maybe made a few missteps around like topical marketing. We might call it CSR marketing now, but I think that sort of reputation precedes Paddy Power. But actually, if you look at the work mostly over the last 5 years, it has gone up a notch in terms of a lot of, sounds really like self-indulgent, but a lot of the work is really considered. It is quite smart. It's a lot of it's very simple, but that's kind of the beauty of what we try and do. So how do you like to be perceived? I guess when we do football stuff, we want to be perceived as, they know their stuff. That's fucking funny. That's fucking on the ball. And that's kind of it. But I guess we often face like this battle against the shadow of our past, because, you know, the way we used to be was right for that time, but things change and things move on. And I think the Paddy Power brand is a really interesting case study of how it's evolved and how this sense of mischief, it has tweaked and altered and changed, but has remained consistent. And perhaps mischief now is really about ambition and being really brave and smart rather than causing a reaction.
I'm really interested in how that change, that transition happens. You said it sort of kicked off 5 years ago, which I think was roughly when you started at the company as well.
Yeah, I'm single-handedly responsible, just to be clear.
It's all down to you, Lee.
So, Lee, basically, you've transitioned. Yeah, but talk about talk about how what the conversations how the conversations progressed. There, obviously, you've already alluded to a corporate grown up, more traditional PR team at Paddy Power. There's yourself, there's marketing, there's brand as well. How did those conversations roll out and develop to sort of go from our perception in the market amongst our customers or the general public is we're laddie? How do we sort of grow up essentially a little bit and be that smarter brand? Can you remember?
So I think a big part of it actually is just the growth of the business. So when I joined, it was about 6 months after Paddy Power had merged with Betfair to form a pretty colossal gambling company in the UK. And then again, earlier this year, Paddy Power's parent company, which is called Flutter, purchased Skybet to create, you know, the biggest gambling company in the world. So as you go from being this sort of punchy underdog, seen off the English outsiders to the biggest in the world, I guess it's probably quite natural that along the way you're going to sort of refine things and you're going to lose, I guess, lovable, roguish stuff. But you can't be the underdog forever, particularly when you're definitely not the underdog. But, you know, I think a good case study might be the story of Ryan Giggs. So shortly before, I think, or when, the Ryan Giggs story broke, Paddy Power's reaction.
Not the one that came out this week as we're recording it.
Not this one, no. I find that one less amusing, to be honest. But when the Ryan Giggs story broke and everyone talked about him, but they couldn't name him, Paddy Power ran an ad with Imogen Thomas in a Man United shirt and Paddy Power pants on page 3 of The Sun, which I think says a lot about the laddie stuff. Still cheeky, still ambitious, still good marketing, I think, of the time. Whereas fast forward maybe 6 or 7 years, and Paddy Power release an advert about loyalty and the Paddy Power loyalty scheme starring Rodri Giggs, Ryan Giggs's scorned brother, and has lots of, I would say, subtler, not completely subtle, but subtler references and mentions. And I think that kind of neatly shows the route one way it used to be, girl, pants, page 3, son, to where it is now or is kind of going towards. But I'm sure we do vary between the two now and again.
Right. Where do your ideas come to you? So are you still a journalist? Are you still always thinking of ideas? Does the fact that you come from a journalist background help you, do you think, with that creative edge?
I think so, because, so as I said, I'm an egomaniac. So when I was at The Sun, I had to have my face in the paper. Like, I was just obsessed with being in the paper. And the only way you could be in the paper when I was there, there was 10 feature writers. Every morning you sent 3 or 4 ideas to your editor, and the best 4 or 5 get pitched to the editor of the paper, and, you know, 2, 3, 4 get put in the paper. So it's highly competitive, and there's lots of really smart grown-ups around you. So every morning I had to come up with ideas, and it wasn't a treadmill. It was really fun, actually, and I was often trimming down some of the wackier nonsense I was sending through. But I guess that was just good practice, the way to scan a newspaper and spot the interesting offbeat stuff, and just to know inherently, like, that story's big, but that's not for me to follow. The short answer to your question is yes, I think it probably did help me. It's just been, and especially going to be topical and reactive, you have to know, therefore, the news agenda and what people are talking about. So it must be a factor.
So you're a PR who's come from a journalist background. You haven't had an experience working in an agency, but what is your relationship with agencies and agency land?
I think it's really fascinating, the dynamic between brands and agencies. And I see a lot of parallels between, we were talking about the journalist approach to agencies, towards PR, sorry. And I can imagine brands aren't that different sometimes towards agencies. I like agencies. I admire them. I don't know how they keep their shit together when they're dealing with nightmare clients. It's really easy to be in my seat, giving feedback or cutting off ideas or being the diva. I don't know how they keep straight faces sometimes. But we kind of, in terms of PR, have like an open door policy to agencies. So again, when I joined, we did have an agency on retainer, but it wasn't working. It went bland. It went stale. I think the nature of what we try to do requires a lot of fresh thinking. So, you know, we say, you know, good ideas can come from anywhere. And that's true. You know, this year we've done stuff that's come from our customer support team. It's come from a different PR agency. It's come from my boss, come from me, it's come from my wife. You know what I mean? It can come from anywhere. So we wouldn't ever close our doors to agencies, but when people like contact me on LinkedIn and say, oh, we'd love to send you our agency credentials, my response typically is, fuck the credentials, send me your ideas. And if your ideas are good, we'll pay for them. That doesn't mean I want you to send me a fully fleshed out, 20-hour invested piece de la resistance. But for Paddy Power, if you can nail an idea in a sentence or two, then we're on to something. And then it shows me that our way of working is probably aligned. And so therefore, in the future, when I do have a specific brief, I will pay you for your time, because I know that you're up my street and you're not going to waste my time.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting to hear about that approach. I think are there lots of agencies that would really like to have Paddy Power on their books, or is it that they genuinely think this is the sort of fun brand that we could do business with?
I get so many people going, oh, I've got a mad idea, or we're great at creating ideas, us, we're mental. And then you get the idea and you go, oh, fucking hell, I've seen that 50 times.
How many times is it floating something down the Thames?
I'm disappointed to say that I'm aware that this is a PR beat, the whole floating something down the Thames. I've never been pitched anything floating down the Thames. There is also a river in Dublin, so that can float stuff, I imagine. So could be a new route, guys. But there are things where people say that they're ambitious or they're provocative or they're crazy. So again, they're thinking about Paddy Power 5 years ago. And then they'll just pitch something really like disappointing, not quite route one, or quite like, oh, right, that's just not us. It's not smart. Or it's, why would Ladbrokes not do that? And that's nothing against Ladbrokes. But, you know, if we're going to be differentiated in the betting industry and segment, we have to be like off the charts in terms of our ambition and whatnot. And I think actually sometimes I find that ideas are too cautious, which really surprises me. Because we say we want really brave ideas. We might scale it back, or it might not be right, but we want to push the boundaries and find out where we stand on this stuff. And when I say that, I guess sometimes people either don't hear it, maybe I mumble it, or they get intimidated by... I've heard a lot of people talk about briefs from brands and how everyone says they want, you know, the stars, and then when it comes to it, they just want what they did last year, but slightly better, right? We don't want that at all. We just want the stars.
How much of your activity, or how do you manage a rolling PR campaign that is split between having proactive and agreed objectives of how you want Paddy Power to be perceived, and then just the sheer opportunity that comes with a new story or an angle or a discovery or a hint or a tip that is going to change and do something special. So how do you balance that sort of clear brand positioning that you want to get over here with these great story opportunities that you just think of, that, you know, your partner tells you, or your mum phones you up and says something, or you see something on the news, or something happens mid-match,
yeah,
mid-race, that there's just an opportunity. How do you strike that balance, and where are the best results from a PR perspective for you?
So we call the campaigny stuff major mischief, and then the tactical reactive stuff mini mischief. Imaginative, I know.
Inspired.
I know. We're so creative. God. The mini mischief stuff, I say we probably broadly aim for one a month, major mischiefs once or twice a year. The campaign stuff is like the Save Our Shirt thing I mentioned. A lot of pre-planning goes into that, although probably less than a lot of brands. But, you know, you've planned out the week by week, day by day, this is how it's going to go. These are all the channels. The mini mischief stuff, it can be turned around in 48 hours. The biggest challenge I think I and my team have is saying, right, yes, that talking point is huge right now. Is it still going to be a talking point on Monday morning or in 2 days' time? It's knowing which moments have enough fire to burn so that we can get our shit together, get the idea, do the activation, get it out there and still be topical. Because there's nothing lamer than doing something a day or two too late. And we really hold ourselves to that. And that means that a lot of ideas which are lovely, are great, are exciting, fall by the wayside. We think, yeah, that's great, but we need to literally do it now or we've missed the boat. And we try to be really strict with that sort of stuff. Because otherwise it's not topical. Sorry.
Having both worked in-house in the past, for both John and I won't speak for you, John, but this idea of being agile and just getting ideas out quickly can often be a struggle when there are approval tiers that one must go through. And I imagine in Paddy Power, there's slightly more, I was going to say, blasé attitude to signing stuff off, but clearly there isn't, because you've got a brand to protect. So how much is there in terms of, I've got an idea and we can just do it, because it will still be newsworthy on Monday morning, but someone else might do it before then? Or, you know, because if you live in a world where you want to be different from the other bookie brands, but there'll be brands in other sectors who have exactly the same makeup as you, who are going after exactly the same people, that might not be, you know, the same laddie nature of what you used to do. But is that a problem for you? Are there great ideas that just don't go out because things can't get signed off in time?
Yeah, I think the nature of creativity is that sometimes you'll have a great idea that for whatever reason can't happen. And sometimes that's for big business reasons that you just have to take on the chin. Sometimes that's for because someone up the chain doesn't quite get it or doesn't like the risk. Sometimes it's budget reasons. I imagine we probably have the similar challenges to a lot of people, although maybe some of the ideas that scared off the CEO probably wouldn't be pitched at many other brands. We talked about beheading a landmark this year, which is an idea just texted me by an agency. I thought, oh my God, that's amazing. But then I realized I had to pitch that to my boss, her boss, the CEO. And it turns out that the word beheading is quite emotive, you know. But so I think we do have approval processes. There is a really rigid structure in terms of protecting the brand. But for the mini mischief stuff, actually, that's quite fluid. It'll usually be like, so we did a thing about Manchester United on transfer deadline day about their hapless CEO, Ed Woodward, and his inability to buy anyone. It was his window shopping emporium. And we put that up the day after they lost 6-1 to Tottenham. And the pitch process for that was a WhatsApp message from me to my boss saying, hello, United have just lost 6-1. Their fans going mad. They can't sign anyone. Here's the gag. Here's the cost. Can we do it? And the answer was yes in about a minute. And we did it. So for smaller stuff, it's quite smooth. But for bigger stuff like the Save Our Shirt thing, again, because that was making a political comment about our industry as a whole, we were saying betting brands shouldn't be on football shirts. That had to go to the very top because obviously the betting industry as a whole does talk to each other, does have relationships. And obviously with the Gambling Act review coming up, do you have to have an understanding? And that would have been Paddy Power going rogue to a certain extent. So that sort of stuff, which is brave, I would say, does need the big dogs to look at it and be behind it. You can't go rogue with that sort of stuff because you probably would get sacked.
Lee, I'm curious. So you said when you moved from the Sun, you hadn't had a huge amount of experience, obviously being a PR. So you worked twice as hard as everyone else. You were, you know, worried about messing up and you know, causing brand damage or whatever, and trying to do something different. Was it difficult to learn to do PR? Was it a piece of piss? What was it like? You just need to understand what it was like being thrown in the deep end. Are there people that you admire? Are there people that you follow? Are there industry bodies that you're kind of interested in? Or do you sort of think, I know my media, I've got this, I just need to come up with ideas?
I don't think I'm the expert by any stretch. I think I didn't find it a piece of piss, but I think doing it for Paddy Power was a blessing, because if I was at a different brand, it might have been a real struggle to do the more day-to-day stuff. Whereas the Paddy Power emphasis is on the more creative, the making the noise stuff, which again kind of was a copy and paste from my previous job. I really admire like so many agencies, and I guess their creative directors or whoever it is, their founders, for the consistency of work across clients. I'm forever just going, fucking hell, they'd have done that for McDonald's, they've done that for Lucozade, they've done that for a makeup brand, they've done that for a dead dog charity. Like, how do they keep this variety of ideas coming and working? I feel like my gig's quite easy because I've just got one area to shoot at, where I look at a lot of agencies and I think, wow, you're doing it left, right, center, up and down. And I'm fascinated. I'm obsessed by the agency world. I know very little about it, but I do look at a lot of work that's done. I read a lot of titles like, you know, PR Week or Marketing Week, they both called that. And I just absorb all the work people do. I find it really inspiring. Sadly, I can't nick much of it with Paddy Power because we're quite particular, but it's still interesting to see. I love seeing ambitious work, and I love just seeing surprising work. And even things like, this can sound ridiculous now after all my bullshit chat, but the Just Eat advert of Snoop Dogg throughout lockdown has just brought me joy. And it's just because it's just going, oh yeah, get fucking Snoop Dogg to sing the advert song that everyone's already half got in their head. I love that, and I'm not ashamed to say I love it, because sometimes guilty pleasures are the best pleasure. So that's my confession.
Nice. I'm interested in your in-house. You oversee PR for Paddy Power. As you said, it's an Irish company originally, mm-hmm. expanded into UK through M&A as well, is you know, largest bookies or gambling company in the world, I think you said there.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the cultural differences in your approach. You know, how does, you know, what sort of thing works in the UK but wouldn't work in the Republic, for instance? You know, are there any cultural differences in the work that you do? Yeah. And how do you sort of make sure that they work for the sort of the target territory?
Yeah, I think so. Paddy Power operates in the UK and Ireland. And Ireland's still, I mean, obviously, a really important territory for Paddy Power. I think it's not over-egging it to say that Paddy Power is like probably top three brands in Ireland. Like, it's a real bedrock of Irish society.
I'm thinking Guinness, and I can't think what the next one would be.
I should know, really, now, shouldn't I?
I just don't want to name it. Gaelic football, as an association. Let's just say that.
Yeah, great. I love it. Do it. And Ireland's fascinating because they've got a lot of specific, so like GAA is a great example, a really purely Irish thing that sort of unites and divides the country simultaneously. They've got a lot of really interesting, very Irish things like the Rose of Tralee, which is the lovely girl competition. If you watch Father of Ted, they had a digging competition with like trucks out in the farms. It's a country that is super sharp, loves jokes, loves comedy, loves writing, loves the arts, loves drinking. It's a place where religion still has a stronger foothold than the UK, and that you can see as a brand like Paddy Power how you might riff off that quite easily. So in recent years, the Pope visited Dublin, for instance, and Paddy Power, my team, erected a drive-through confessional box to quickly confess all your sins since the last time the Pope's been, because the joke is everyone's a relapsed Catholic in Ireland, or under a certain age they are. I think it's a really interesting country that is actually more diverse than you might think, but has this real contrast of certain things like the religion seeming like it's from 10 years ago, and then other elements being completely different and more open-minded than the UK. So it is a very different market to the UK, I would say. But they're obsessed with the Premier League, which helps me, and the majority of Paddy Power staff are Irish and fully understand the culture and society there. So I'm very conscious of going over there and going, guys, got a great idea for Irish PR. Let me tell you about Ireland. I like to listen to what they say first and then maybe develop a few ideas.
So I was just going to say, in light of the time that you've spent there and the things that you've learned, especially from the journalist background, do you think more PR should be from that side of the fence? Do you think there's something that's a quite important or unique lesson, whether that's in terms of writing or seeing a news story or just coming up with ideas that actually make people better PRs if they've been a journalist first?
Yeah, I think you're going to pitch. Basically, what we do with press releases or campaigns is we're pitching our story to journalists and editors. So it's kind of the same process as what I used to do, albeit a bit more fleshed out. So I don't see how that wouldn't help having an understanding. And, you know, you hear phrases like newsjacking all the time. That just means basically doing their work for them. And that's what good PR is about, saying, hey, I've got a story for you. Let me do your work for you while getting my brand left, right and centre all over your publication. But I think it would be helpful. And I also think that there's something good about coming into an industry that has a lot of things that are set in their ways and just being able to ask stupid questions. I was constantly asking, why do we do that? Why is that the case? What's AVE? Why is 100 hits a week good? Like lots of basic bitch questions. That's my speciality. But I think being able to approach PR with a fresh pair of eyes helped me in my particular brand, in my particular role, to sort of develop it or to steer it in the right direction for Paddy Power.
I'm curious to know, has lockdown and working remote impacted the amount of creativity that you, your team and your company have? Have you been able to recreate what was probably quite a boisterous and fun office environment with all of you working remotely?
I think it's a really personal, sorry, not saying I'm offended by your question, but I think it's quite a personal journey. So I think it depends on your nature as a person. I always actually found that being in the office was great for sort of planting the seeds, or we didn't do brainstorms, but having chats and laughing, maybe sowed a seed here or there, but it wouldn't be until hours later on the train home or eating dinner where the idea would really develop. So I actually found, I've always found, coming away from stuff and just having my own space quite helpful. So actually working from home is quite good in some ways for that sort of stuff. But doesn't mean you're staring at fucking Zoom or you're on your phone or whatever to try and get to the first bit. But a lot of people require that social energy to get their creative juices flowing. Like some of my colleagues like need to be in person to really to find their sweet spot. So it's just finding a way that makes it work for you without going stir crazy, which I think is the point at which we're all reaching, really. Of, you know, I find myself talking to myself now while I'm writing emails, or I've been in this room for so long that I would quite like to be in the office again, but not to enhance creativity, just to maybe find some stability in my mentality.
Yeah, I mean, I talk to the dog all the time, first point. and secondly, I think it's really interesting what you said there, because we've certainly had feedback. I mean, this entire season has been produced throughout 2020 since going into lockdown one, which we can probably branded as now. So it's really interesting to hear you not quite go against the grain with what we've heard, but certainly, you know, everybody, a lot of people when we discuss this with them say, oh yeah, we miss that sort of serendipity of ideas and the sort of spontaneity of everything. So it's interesting to hear that, you know, yes, things can be seeded, but it's not until everybody takes a step back that those sorts of ideas grow and become more fully fleshed in your own mind. So I think it's a really interesting point there.
Sorry, they're still serendipitous and they're still spontaneous, but it's just usually I'm scratching my backside in the shower or I've got a mouthful of chocolate or something, rather than being in the office or being on the train home. But again, it is an individual thing, but I've never been particularly wedded to working 9 to 5 Monday to Friday in an office anyway. Again, that's down to the nature of my role at The Sun and the nature of being a PR and being a PR at Paddy Power. I've always felt, I don't know, a comfort in my own space and being able to go, right, I'll close the door on the noise, close the door on all the, you know, the chit chat you've got to do, all the bullshit, breathe. Okay, that's the idea. Where do we go with it? Or can we go anywhere with it? And that's just what works for me, but it doesn't mean it'll work for everyone.
I think that's quite an interesting concept, actually, when it comes to creativity. I think a lot of, as John said, a lot of the people that we've spoken to this season have been all about the serendipity, which we've got in three times now in this episode. It's our sort of word of the season, I think. Everyone's sort of it's the one definitely. Long word we all know. ideas. But actually, I think about the creative director we have at the agency where I work, who travels up and down the M11 every day, and keeps a notebook, and constantly has to pull over because this is where the ideas come. And actually, it's that creation of space and being away, and it just ties to some people it works really well, and other people it doesn't. I think it's interesting. You talk about how that affects you as a person. Do you think Paddy Power has accelerated the change in which you try and promote your brand and position yourself, obviously in terms of the way in which you're utilizing digital offerings anyway? Has it changed your business much or not to a huge degree?
So I think this year's been interesting in terms of our output, because it should have had a massive Cheltenham campaign, should have had a massive Euro 2020 campaign or four, and then the things we would have liked to have done around the Premier League restarting were affected by the weird way it came back and the weird way of the world. But when I look back at the work we've done this year, I'd say a lot of it has been quintessentially Paddy Power. Like, you'd see it and you go, ah, Paddy Power, despite all of the excuses and caveats you could have had. And like, we talk about mini mischief, there's still about 9 pieces of mini mischief this year. There's still at least 1 piece of major mischief. And bearing in mind, there's 3 or 4 things that couldn't happen for logistical purposes. I had a really great one, I thought, for the US election, which couldn't do because lockdown in Ireland and various other stuff. So, but what did happen was, when lockdown first happened, we all went, oh, mischief doesn't feel great right now, does it? And that was the right call. The world wasn't looking for piss taking. It wasn't looking for someone causing trouble. So how that shifted was, in June, we put on the UK's first sporting event post lockdown, which was a golf tournament with various top golfers and various top celebrities. But they weren't just playing golf. They were doing various funny golf challenges, blah, blah, blah. Loads of content all through our channels. And that version of mischief was of its time, but it was about entertainment. It was about escapism. It was about knowing that our partners are fucking gagging for some sport. We're fucking gagging for some sport. So let's just do some sport. And it wasn't easy. The idea was, I'll be able to do a golf tournament. And then you've got to actually put it on, and you've got to get everyone COVID tested, and you've got to do all the distancing and all the rest of it. That was the first of its type in the UK, and the European Tour of Golf used that as a template for all of their actual events that followed. So that piece of mischief I'm actually really proud of. It's not, you wouldn't say, oh, that's inherently mischievous, but actually the nature of it was ambitious. It was going, fuck it, we're going to do this. And that's very Paddy Power. And then we've done like smaller beats along the way, which have just been tactical, and the timing's made sense, which since June, it's been a lot easier to do stuff in the real world, then we have done it. So we would like to have done loads of massive stuff for the Euros, but that's next summer now. So we'll just park those ideas till then.
Lee, is there one campaign that you've worked on for Paddy Power that you're immensely proud of more than any others?
The obvious answer is the Save Our Shirt thing, which was the first thing I brought up myself organically. But I'm actually really proud as well of a piece of work we did in 2018 before the World Cup, which was an alternative World Cup. It's called CONIFA. It's Confederation of Independent Football Associations, countries not recognised by FIFA, places like Tibet or Isle of Man. Am I proud, or I just can't believe I got away with it? But me and Paddy went on an around-the-world documentary series we made. We made a 6-part documentary series. So we went to Zimbabwe, we went to Tibet, we went to the States to meet this independent nation within the US. And then we actually put on a World Cup in London a month before the real World Cup. And was it the most successful thing Paddy Power ever done? No, not by a long shot. But I stand by the fact the content was unbelievable. The documentary series, I watched it again the other day. I'm in love with it. Right Said Fred wrote the theme tune for the tournament, obviously. It was just so fun. I think for me, my measure of success for work is the anecdotes that come from it, or the memories. And that was just so rich in terms of, oh yeah, a few years ago I went to Tibet. You went where? Or, you know, got right, said Fred to do this, and that I'm really proud of, perhaps for the wrong reasons. And then just quickly, at the actual World Cup, we did a campaign called Rainbow Russians, where Russia was rich with territories for brands, a lot of them very obvious, but no one was talking about the rainbow-coloured elephant in the room and Putin's, you know, terrible gay rights record. So we thought we would. And we said every time Russia scored, we donate £10,000 to an LGBTQ plus charity. So Russia were funding gay rights ultimately. And that went amazingly, helped by the fact that Russia won their first game 5-0 and immediately bust my budget for the campaign. also, that did equal a lot of coverage, of course. So we ended up raising $170,000 that tournament for LGBTQ plus rights. So well done, Putin, and well done, Russia.
I mean, so this is a bit at odds with your position at Paddy Power. As we said before we started recording, some of the campaigns you've been doing, Save Our Shirts, the LGBTQ campaign with Russia in the 2018 World Cup or Euros. Apologies, I'm not a football fan. Okay. It was the World Cup. There is a strong theme of social responsibility and social awareness and good causes there. And I just wonder how much of that is a rebalancing for a company that essentially is, you know, it is gambling. It's probably perceived by some quarters as, you know, one of the sort of evil activities legal activities in the world, tobacco, alcohol, all that sort of stuff. Do you feel like part of the corporates, these sort of social responsible campaigns, are a way to balance that out a bit?
I could see why you'd say that. The honest answer is I don't think so, but I guess, does it hurt that there's an extra benefit? Probably not. But none of those two campaigns, for instance, none of those weren't formed out of us going, right, what CSR thing can we do? In fact, both of those, our CSR team didn't want to know. They wanted to do whatever they wanted to do. Those campaigns came out of a good idea that made sense and spoke to our audience. The LGBTQ plus one in Russia, we liked it because, A, it was fucking true. No one else was talking about it. Mm. And the mischief in that was just inherent in the bravery of sticking it to Putin. And one of my favourite things about that campaign was that when we posted the announcement video, there was a portion of our followers on Facebook or people comment on Facebook who wrote things like, I don't know, fuck the gays, what about children of cancer, or what about the kittens, or there was like some homophobic reactions. And we decided to respond to that by doing a fan denial video, which is something we do every week, mocking morons on the internet. And we actually mocked our own commenters and followers who were moaning about our campaign to say, this is who we are, this is what we're doing. If you don't like it, you're an idiot, basically. And I think that kind of sums up our approach to CSR, in inverted commas. It's not about doing CSR. It's just about, it's about those things like sharp-wittedness and being on the ball and being topical. It's not a conscious decision to say, right, we're going to do something nice now. It's just kind of common sense. And to be fair, Paddy Power has got a history in LGBTQ plus rights. You know, we launched Rainbow Laces, which is now a phenomenal success. We've done a lot of work with sponsored Brighton Pride, for instance. So our fit in that territory is probably easier than some. I actually pitched a Black Lives Matter idea back in February before it went truly nuclear in the following months. And that was a more difficult territory because we'd never touched racism as a subject. And we consciously said, we don't want to do this just because it's being nice about racism, or whatever the phrasing should be. We don't want to be disingenuous, because I think if we were doing something for the wrong reasons, that would come across, that would undermine our campaign, and it wouldn't be successful. And that's not what we want. We want to do good marketing. If it happens to be good marketing that has a feel-good payoff, great. Save Our Shirt, again, wasn't really classically CSR. It had a good message at the end, i.e. the shirt should be clean for fans. But that's because it was a genuine fan insight. It was true. It wasn't because we thought, oh, we're going to win some brownie points here. I think if you say, right, we're going to do a CSR campaign, what we're going to do, you're not going to find the right idea. Mm-hmm. If you say, we're going to do a marketing campaign, what should we do? that's when it works. There's no such thing as a CSR idea. It's just a marketing idea or a brand idea, I think.
I'm really curious. So two things spring to mind. You did a degree in sports journalism. Sorry, you just choked on your drink.
Such a generous description of what I did, but yeah, sorry, go on.
You did a degree in sports journalism. Hugely competitive. A lot of fortunate people want to be a sports journalist. Mm. You then went and worked in a highly competitive place, working as a feature writer for The Sun. Huge numbers of people want to work for national newspapers, and the opportunity is huge. You're now working in probably one of the top PR gigs in the country in terms of what you're doing from an in-house role. What advice do you have for other people who are keen to develop their careers and follow their dreams in that regard? That's the first part, and I ask very long-winded questions. The second part is, because of your wonderful LinkedIn profile, I can see that over the last couple of years, you've taken a number of courses or programs that have actually given you much deeper and richer understanding of marketing. So how important is it in your mind to keep accelerating and growing your understanding of marketing, things like the mini MBA, and you've done marketing strategy at Cornell. What's the driver behind that, and what advice does that play for other people?
To answer the second one first, just because I can remember that most prominently, I guess the marketing courses and whatnot is kind of based on that feeling of being a fraud. Like, I didn't study PR, I didn't study marketing, and yet here I am overseeing major PR campaigns or marketing campaigns. Like, I'm seeing myself overseeing a TV advert being shot. I've got no training in that. So it's just trying to see what all the adults learn and how I can adapt that into my own approach. And this kind of ties into the first question. I think you just have to, and it's really easy to say, it sounds like a buzzword, it sounds very LinkedIn. You just have to be authentic, and you can't live a lie. Like, I can't live a lie. I would be really unhappy. I have to be me. And that means that am I super corporate, slick, professional man in the office? No, I'm not. Does that mean I'm quite laid back and aloof? Yes, it is. Does that mean I like wearing black T-shirts rather than shirts and ties? Yes. You know, just these things that are me, I have to stick to, so I'm comfortable. I think you can't achieve anything if you're trying to dance someone else's tune or meet someone else's expectations. So you have to really find what works for you, who you are. Sounds like life coaching, doesn't it? But I think you have to find what works for you, because that's what works for you. Like, you can't just copy and paste everyone else. Like, I can't say to someone, do what I did and you'll be me, because you won't. You'll just be a shit version of you. But I do think you have to be open-minded. I do think you have to be willing to learn and do the hard yards. Like, I am a professional blagger, fine, but I'm willing to work hard at blagging it. And if I can gain an advantage through doing the course at Cornell, which I thought would take me to New York but didn't, gutted, or doing a mini MBA, then great. And those things, I did them. The mini MBA, for instance, was really, really intelligent stuff. And what it mostly taught me was that I don't want to go into a marketing role in the future. I don't want to talk about segmentation. I don't want to talk about these things. I like brand, creative, this sort of stuff. But until you investigate, you don't know. And there were lots of interesting little tidbits from that course that stick with me now. Like, I know what the word segmentation means, for instance, which is a help. I just, if I can, why not? Like, I've always had this really lame thing that my number one hobby is doing more work. So I love a little side project. So I wrote books when I was at The Sun on the side, because I'm a loser. And having children hasn't slowed that down. So I guess the courses were kind of an excuse not to talk to my wife at night. I don't know. Hope she hasn't heard that, because I'll be dead. I do these things. It's not for anyone else other than me. And just to think, well, do I want to do marketing? Because I think I went to Australia for a few weeks to work at Paddy Power's partner brand over there. And they were amazing. I went to their office and they were talking about 1 year, 3 year, 5 year plans all the while. And I thought, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, you've all, like, your boss is there. You can't talk about what you want to be in 3 years. But they had this real amazing culture of having these plans and working out what bits they're missing and what steps I needed to take. And that really inspired me to think, okay, I'm in a job I love. Do I want to be doing it in 5 years? I don't know. What could I be doing it? Maybe it's a marketing director role. What would I need to do to get there? I did some of that stuff and I thought, nah, fuck that. So I think being open with your ambitions and thinking about where you want to go is probably quite healthy. It's probably not very British, and I don't tend to tell loads of people about my ambitions, but I think it's a good thing to explore stuff and try things and find out, hey, actually, I do quite like that stuff. I'm going to do more of that.
I think that's brilliant. I think people need to be much more honest about it. I had an agency leader once talk to me about like team management and people management, and this whole concept that you don't own people, you've just got them on loan, you know, and so actually, if we put the football analogy, you've got them on loan. So you've got them because they're really good at something and you've got a need, and they can be really effective for you because they often come and they're better and they'll do a really good job. But that idea of you really work them, you know, but you also train in them and you invest them and you guide them and you coach them, but you've got that understanding that they're here to do a job and they might not stay forever. And that's okay, because people do move and people do change and people do, you know, move around. And I think that mentality of trying to, well, I think we should all be a bit more open about what we want to achieve and where we want to achieve it and how we want to grow. And maybe if we did that, we'd all, I don't know, work better with our industry peers to help and support each other a bit more. But if people do want to copy exactly what you've done and steal what you do, they can obviously read your LinkedIn profile, but where else might people find you on social media, or where they might want to read your books, your novels, your ideas?
They totally won't. I wouldn't bother looking me up, to be honest. So I am on Twitter, obviously. I'm more of a lurker these days, and I actually delete most of my tweets because they're just failed jokes. So LinkedIn's fine. Don't try and sponsor your podcast. I won't. Sorry. If you want to copy what I did, I would read the LinkedIn and decide that I'm an idiot. So don't copy me, copy someone better. But yeah, LinkedIn and Twitter, if you fancy that.
And if agencies want to pitch for you, what advice would you have for them?
Make sure you're pitching a Paddy Power idea to Paddy Power. Don't pitch me an idea that you've pitched to 17 other brands that didn't work for them either. I don't want to see your credentials. I'm sure they're lovely and they're shiny, but they don't mean anything to me. I'm a simple creature. Send me the starting of an interesting idea, and then let's have a chat. Just email it through lee.price@paddypower.com or LinkedIn or whatever. But please don't send me 25 slide decks about how great you are. I won't read it. Again, I'm sorry. That was really horrible.
Thanks to Lee Price from Paddy Power for joining us on the show. If you want to follow Lee, as he said, he's a bit of an observer on Twitter these days, but you can follow his exploits on the little blue bird at Lee_Price. You can also reach out and follow him on LinkedIn as well. Beware, he will not sponsor your podcast. We tried and he still said no. But if you do want to sponsor us, do get in touch. You never know. We might actually go for that idea. You can follow us on Twitter as well at PR Hub. I'm at John Wilcox _ Adam is at Adam Tuckwell. Don't forget to like and subscribe as well, actually, folks, because it's important to increase our visibility on Apple Podcasts and other platforms. And until next time, thanks for listening. Bye.